you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Dukmasova, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time in the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I sit here in this frigid day, Friday, January 7th, 2022, the headlines in the New York Times tell it all and pretty much tell what we're going to be talking about in a bit. Biden condemns Trump as U.S. remembers Capitol riot. Key word in that sentence is remembers. Not everybody remembers it the same way. And not a lot of people don't think are remember it at all. It's like a dream or an illusion or a nightmare. Who knows? Anyway, as I do with all distinguished guests, I ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself, and then we're just going to take it away. So distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be back. Happy New Year to everyone. I'm David Ferris. I'm an associate professor of political science at Roosevelt University. Contributing writer at The Week and the author of It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority, which at this point I think means going back in time and winning the Maine Senate race. I don't know what else to tell you. Not a good situation out there. But, you know, it's a new year. It's getting 1 minute. Each day's getting 1 minute longer. So, you know, that's not everything's bad.
No, right? That's true. Is that what it is? 1 minute a day? By the way, I cannot recall, and this is a sign either of senility moving in or just don't want to remember, who were the two candidates in the Maine Senate race? Susan Collins, I know, was victorious. Who were we looking forward to is to defeat Susan Collins to give Democrats a Manchin-proof control over the Senate? Do you remember the name of the candidate?
Yeah, her name was Sarah Gideon. And she was the Speaker of the Maine House, I believe. And seems like a perfectly fine candidate to me. I don't live in Maine, and the polls were so lopsided in Gideon's favor, I wasn't actually paying that close attention to it. So I kind of just had it penciled in. But I think, you know, one thing is I think that Mainers, as we like to call themselves, Mainers have a real independent streak. And so I was talking to somebody from Maine who said that they should have run an independent, you know, somebody who was so closely identified with the Democratic Party. For whatever reason, especially against Collins, was less of a good pick. So whether that's true or not, I couldn't really tell you. I didn't think that Gideon ran a terrible campaign in as much as I thought all Democrats ran a fairly terrible campaign in 2020. And she ran the same one, but it didn't seem like worse than anybody else's. So I don't have a great explanation for you there. You know,
I don't have an explanation at all. I was pretty much surprised. I had every guest that came on the show was predicting Gideon would win, that this is it, it's all over. So anyway, let's not revisit that. There are 3 points I'd like to make in today's show and get your thoughts on. One is that the Cheneys were the only Republicans at the Congressional Remembrance Ceremony. Wow. Ted Cruz got beat up by Tucker Carlson. Double wow. And this one is... This is just, put this in the category of absurd. Among the people petitioning Joe Manchin, begging with him to join the filibuster crusade, is Oprah Winfrey. And that's how desperate the Dems are. They've enlisted their celebrity friends. I don't know what influence Oprah Winfrey would have over Joe Manchin that nobody else has. But we'll get to those eventually. But the first thing I want to talk about is your very sobering essay in The Week that I read this morning. First thing I read this morning, I was so depressed. that's okay. It's sort of David Ferris's State of the Democracy essay for the start of the 2022 New Year's. And it is sobering, to put it mildly. Why don't you just share with listeners your general themes in this particular essay?
Sure. I mean, so it was an anniversary essay for January 6th, you know, which we had planned well in advance. And, you know, when you're pitching these in advance articles to the editors, you know, you kind of have to tell them what you're going to say. And I said, you know, what I'm going to say, I think, is kind of obvious, but like we saw what happened on January 6th. I think the weaknesses in our democracy and the hostility of the Republican Party to that democracy were very obvious that day. We were quite lucky that no members of Congress were killed. And it should have been a galvanizing moment. I'm not so naive, I guess, as to think it to be a unifying moment, but it should have at least galvanized the new Democratic majority, not just to pass these voting rights reinforcements, but to do other things to try to coup-proof our democracy. That is to put back some of the guardrails that have been taken down by Donald Trump and his friends. But not just him, right? I mean, this is Republican Party stuff going back 20 years. That's what the John Lewis Voting Rights Act is about. It's what the For the People Act is about. It's to try to push back against some of the more simple ways that Republicans have been trying to rig elections in their favor. And not only have we not done that, we also haven't really tried to address the other flaws that were, you know, kind of specific to January 6th, right? Which was, why do we have to count the electoral votes in the first place? It's all very silly. The Electoral College itself is really the cause of this problem, but we can't do anything about it without an amendment. And so the essay just kind of laments the lack of momentum that we have made towards addressing the clear weaknesses that our democracy has, the ways that our adversaries have figured out how to exploit those weaknesses, and even to like identify more precisely what the threat is, you know. And so I called it a lost year. It was a lost year for democracy saving efforts. And it may be the case that it's the fault of two or three people in the Senate, but that doesn't matter. You know, like we can shout from the rubble, you know, like it was just Manchin and Sinema. The rest of the Democrats were fine. It doesn't matter, right? Like the problems have not been fixed. You know, I read that they're talking about rewriting the Electoral Count Act in a bipartisan fashion. I mean, wake me up when that happens. But the problems go beyond that. And the last point I make in the article, probably the thing that got you most depressed, Ben, is that there is no, I don't actually think there's a way to coup-proof a democracy, because ultimately there's no like dead man's hand at work here, right? At some point in the system, from the act of voting to certifying the votes to making sure that the people who won office get to take it, there are human beings who have to abide by and enforce the constitutional procedures by which we transfer power peacefully in this country. And you really, there's not an easy way around the problem of like one of our two political parties that commands the support of roughly half the population is no longer committed to those procedures and can no longer be trusted to carry them out. That's the scariest thing. It's the thing that doesn't have a fix in Congress, right? And what I would really like is for the president and his allies and every elected Democrat to start talking about this problem, not in terms of a vague threat to democracy or not in terms of Donald Trump, which was the focus of Biden's speech yesterday, but as a problem of the Republican Party itself. And they just cannot bring themselves to do that yet. And that's, it's been a huge disappointment to me.
Yeah, you've been saying that for a while, and I agree with you. And it's a constant theme in my writings as well. I try to inject a little gallows humor into it, but it's getting harder and harder. Particularly when I take a look at like this one particular congressional race in Illinois, where there's two incumbents facing off, Rodney Davis versus Mary Miller. It is so bizarre, but it just speaks so much of the Republican Party. And this is the point I'm going to make. The Republican Party has dedicated itself to the proposition that the election was stolen. Now, that's not true. You know it's not true, but they've dedicated to themselves that. There are only, as I can think, two Republicans running for election for Congress right now who have openly, no, one. One that I can think of, one, Liz Cheney, one Republican congressperson who is opposed to that notion and is running for re-election. Adam Kinzinger is opposed to that notion, but he's not running for re-election. So, and so even Rodney Davis, who is quote unquote a moderate, and boy, is that word, has word lost all its meaning with the Republican Party. Even Rodney Davis, he just won't deal with it. He'll just look the other way. So you could present him with all the evidence from your essay in the week that shows about how this was just a blatant attempt to steal an election, and Donald Trump trying to bully election officials throughout the country into announcing that he was the winner, not Joe Biden, intimidate them, which has got to be illegal. Even in the face of that evidence, the moderates in the Republican Party won't take a stand, and they won't take a stand because I believe they've correctly come to the conclusion that the overwhelming majority of the voters in their primary agree with Trump, think that Trump was in the right. They may think that the election was stolen, or they may not even care, and they just want Trump to win, and they don't care, you know, whatever it takes mentality. And I don't know, David, in the face of such cowardice on the part of the moderates and such determination on the part of the MAGA people, how in the world we can even continue to persist with this fantasy of a bipartisan Congress, a bipartisan Senate, a bipartisan country where we put aside our political differences just to agree on one set of rules governing the process. And that's where I agree with you. I was disappointed with Joe Biden's speech because he tried to just, he wouldn't even mention Trump by name, by the way. I don't know if you noticed that, but he just tried to, like, right there is a difference, David. Donald Trump will not only mention Joe Biden by name, will come up with nicknames to belittle him, but Joe Biden's like above the fray. So I don't know. I don't see how we can come up with any of these solutions that you talk about in the face of rock solid opposition from the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think that's the. I think the frustrating thing right now about being a Democrat and someone who would like to make the country work better for the people that live in it is that there's not an obvious path forward over the next year, right? Like, it's not like we're getting more senators tomorrow. It's like, Happy New Year. Now you have a 53-seat majority. No, it's the same one. It's the same two people that are standing in the way of I mean, there's the two same two people are standing in the way of some of this stuff. I mean, obviously, a lot of the other stuff's not even get talked about, but, you know, it's just, we're just going to have to get a bigger majority to do some of those things. But yeah, I mean, it's very few Republicans are willing to even acknowledge that Joe Biden won. I think 97% of them know perfectly well that Joe Biden won the election. And there's a couple of dummies who actually believe this stuff. But that's what makes it so maddening, is that the level of cynicism here is really breathtaking. I actually think it was, didn't Ted Cruz go out and say, well, you know, my constituents believe the election was stolen, so I have to represent them. And I think that's actually the attitude among many people on the right. That is elected Republicans who are, you know, most of them are not stupid, right? Like, they know, you know, they know that people in four specific cities didn't get together and rig the election perfectly, but then forget to rig the Senate elections, right? Like, none of the stuff even adds up in a like remotely plausible fashion. What most of them are doing is the story they're probably telling themselves is, you know, I believe in Republican principles and Republican governance, and just indulging this lie is better than turning power over to the Democrats, right? Like, they think it's so important to stay in power that they can justify to themselves eroding the legitimacy, the shared legitimacy of our democracy. And they are doing so without any meaningful suggestions about how they want to fix the problems that they perceive with the election system in this country, right? And it's like, in a functioning country, a deal could be made here, right? To try to restore faith on both sides, right? Because rank and file Republicans do believe that the election was stolen. That's not my fault. And I don't really think it's my problem necessarily to disabuse them of that notion. But that's where we are, right? A supermajority of Republicans think the election was stolen. Now, that still leaves, 30% of Republican voters. They know Joe Biden won, right? Like, they know this is all theater. And that's a big block of voters who I do think could be reachable theoretically. But those people really need to be convinced, and the independents need to be convinced, and low propensity voters need to be convinced that the stakes here are high enough to we got to turn out in November. We don't have a choice. I'm not happy about it. I'm not happy about much of what has happened over the past year. But that requires Biden to talk about it. I mean, you listened to that speech yesterday. It's a beautifully written speech. I got to hand it to the speechwriter, but there was, maybe 1 minute about the Republican Party, and it was framed as, the great party of Lincoln and Reagan and Bush has gone adrift. He said, I'm worried that it's turning into something else. And I'm like, buddy, that ship sailed. Like, it has already happened. Like, the party, the GOP that you mythologize in your, 79-year-old Senate brain, not only never existed in the first place, right? They were always racist. So they were always trying to prevent Democrats from winning elections. This is, post-World War II here. Not only did it never exist, it hasn't existed for, even the thing that you think existed hasn't existed for 10 years. And so it's fascinating to watch Joe Biden slowly come to terms with this, like in a sociological fashion. I'm fascinated watching this transformation in him where he's like, oh man, these guys are really bad. Guess I was wrong. But we don't have time for that. You know what I mean? Like, we don't have time for Joe Biden to finally think it through and realize that the real threat is the Republican Party. They're not going to work with him. The infrastructure bill was for show. It was designed precisely to slow down momentum towards these reforms. If they agree to rewrite the Electoral Count Act, that will be the same thing, right? They will be rewriting the Electoral Count Act. If your listeners need a primer on that, I'd be happy to do that. But it is a little bit arcane. But if Mitch McConnell agrees to rewrite the Electoral Count Act, it's because he doesn't want voting rights reform passed. He doesn't want statehood for DC. He doesn't want any of these other things to happen, right? He wants these two show votes to demonstrate this false bipartisanship. And so far, Democrats are kind of just like falling for it every time. So that's where we are. It's not great.
All right. You know what? Why don't you indulge yourself and me in a bit of an explanation about rewriting the Electoral Count Act. You get into that in your essay. And yes, it's in the weeds, but I can assure you the people that listen to this podcast like going into the weeds. They like smoking weed, too. But they particularly like taking that deep dive into the weeds. So don't hold back. That's kind of where we're at on this podcast. So explain what you were getting at in your essay about rewriting the Electoral Count Act.
Sure. So the Electoral Count Act of, 1887 was written precisely because there was a dispute about the counting of electoral votes in 1876. So that's the election that ended Reconstruction. They agreed to make Democrats agreed to make Rutherford B. Hayes president, the Republican, in exchange for essentially ending federal oversight of the South and reimposing white supremacy there. But there was a dispute with the number of electoral votes that the country was paralyzed for quite some time, and they realized that the Constitution doesn't actually get specific enough about what happens if there's a dispute about a state's electoral vote. And they of course didn't foresee that dispute because they didn't imagine any of this working the way that it does in the first place, right? Like the Electoral College was supposed to be a bunch of wise men, you know, sort of reviewing the votes of the few white other white men who are allowed to vote and then deciding, you know, what's the best choice here. It was not meant to be a system that takes a popular vote and then translates it magically into these electoral votes. And so inevitably, you know, we ended up with a dispute in 1876. It got very serious. It was a constitutional crisis. And so they wrote this law. It took them a long time to write this law, which is incredible because it's like one of the worst pieces of writing I have ever seen in my entire life. I encourage your listeners to go pull it up. It's, you know, maybe 1,000 words of just complete and utter nonsense that is not just unreadable, but almost uninterpretable. But the takeaway of this act is like, okay, so it works like this, right? The states send a certified slate of electors to Congress, and the sitting vice president of the United States, another incredibly stupid thing, the sitting vice president of the United States gets to stand up in a joint session of Congress and count them. So it's supposed to be ceremonial, right? Like, and the people of New York transmit 26 electoral votes for this person, right? And it typically has been ceremonial. Anyway, buried in the text of this ridiculous statute are a number of procedures that the Trump team figured out that they could exploit. They're not the first people to ever object to electoral votes from a state, okay? But if this was the first systematic effort to prevent the winner of an election from taking office by objecting to the results in multiple states and trying to then throw the election to the House of Representatives, where it would be decided by a vote of state delegations that each get one vote, and Trump would have won that vote. Okay. So buried deep in the text of the statute, it says that if one senator and one member of the House object to the legitimacy of the electors that have been transmitted to Congress, then they have to retire into separate sessions and deliberate and take an up or down vote about whether to sustain those objections. Allowing, in effect, Congress to overturn the will of the voters if they so desire. And it's not clear anywhere in that statute who or what entity could stop them from doing that. Presumably, this would end up in front of the Supreme Court. But in a situation where the outcome is really disputed and it's not obvious who won, I don't know what the court would do there. In the situation last year in 2020, I do believe that Supreme Court would still have ruled for Biden, right? But it's not clear. Okay, let me back up a step. So the way that people want to rewrite the Electoral Count Act is to raise the threshold to reject the votes from a particular state. And so as it stands, simple majority in the House, 218, simple majority in the Senate, 51, can say like, okay, we're going to toss out the votes from Arizona, and or we're going to accept the alternate slate of electors that was submitted by the whatever state legislature or whoever. So two outcomes. They could reverse the outcome. They could not count the electoral votes from that state, which could conceivably deprive someone of 270, throw it to the House. And so they want to raise the threshold from a simple majority to some kind of supermajority, 60%, 67%, whatever takes you beyond the simple majority partisan threshold, right? Like, in order to do this, you need to have more people on board than just those on your team, right? And so 67% is that surefire number. Like, neither party has had a 67% majority in both chambers in a very long time. So you're essentially partisan proofing it, right? And it sounds appealing on its face, but it has one really significant flaw. And that's that if you raise the threshold to object and set aside electoral votes from a particular state, you actually make it harder to stop the states from committing election fraud. Does that make sense? So imagine this year, I was going to say next year, but it is in fact 2022. Got to be better than 2021, right? What a disappointment that year was. Anyway, so let's say that the Republican candidate wins Michigan, the governorship this year. Republicans hold on to the state legislature. And in 2024, Michigan is very close again. And the state legislature and the governor work together to overturn. So it's like, okay, let's say that Biden wins Michigan by 3,000 votes or something. It's really close. And there's a dispute about the counting of certain ballots, you know, absentees, whatever. And so the governor just signs the Republican slate of electors, even though it looked like Biden has more votes. And the governor sends that official, you know, approved state results to Congress. And says, okay, here it is. These are the Michigan results. In that case, to reverse that act of election theft would in fact require Congress to reject the electors from Michigan. And so neither raising the threshold nor taking this choice out of Congress's hands altogether really solves the problem of Republicans in charge of the states, the state legislatures and the governorships and the attorney general's offices and any secretaries of state, right? Like any of these statewide offices that are in control of election machinery can be manipulated. In fact, those plans are underway. And so if you take this out of Congress's hands, all you're going to do is make it easier for them to steal it at the state level. Right? It's like this unbreakable circle of Republican hostility to democracy. That it's like, if you want to reinforce it at this point, you open up the pipe bursts at some other point in the system, because the problem is not the system. I mean, the system is a problem, right? The system could be a lot better, but there is no system that can guarantee that people committed to overturning an election result can't do it. I just don't think that a statute could be written that achieves that.
Wait, by the way, finish this thought. The problem is not the system. The problem is the what? Fill in that blank.
Republican Party, right? The problem is the Republican Party. The system is, you know, it is a clever design in the sense of there are a number of different points in our system to prevent outright election theft from happening. Okay. The voting systems are distributed. It's not like there's a national database you can hack into. The actual voting procedures are done in 51 different places, right? It's hard to rig that from Washington. You've got opportunities for Congress to weigh in on disputed elections. You've got the court system that could presumably step in. And so that can work, right? But like, it's not a system designed to withstand multiple efforts to undermine it across multiple election cycles from an authoritarian party that is learning from its own mistakes and how it failed to do this last year. They are ruthlessly setting about, running candidates who are committed to the big lie. They are running candidates for local election offices and secretaries of state. You know, they want people who sign those documents and send them to Congress. They want their people in those offices. Whether they can really pull it off, Ben, I don't know. Whether we come to that brink, whether they would really do it, I don't know. But I know that the threat is real. I know that it cannot be solved exclusively by rewriting this ancient statute. Getting rid of the Electoral College is really the only thing I think that would significantly mitigate this threat. And so when you can't design a system that is impervious to sabotage, what you have to do is you got to be on your toes. It is up to Democrats and is up to the Democratic voters to save democracy, right? And it's like, yeah, we got our work cut out for us. And we may lose without the Republicans having to cheat in 2022 and 2024 if things keep going the way they've been going. They're not going to have to rig anything. They're just going to win. And in some ways, that's probably preferable to a disputed election that results in Trump taking office by some, or Ron DeSantis or whoever, by overturning state election results. I really think that would break the country. So that's where we are. It's like, oh, okay. So getting crushed would actually be better than,
yeah,
than losing by a little.
No, a legitimate loss as opposed to a theft. I get your point. Would be better. I, in the midst of the gloom, I would say this, but I'm going to come back to your. I just don't think that Donald Trump can beat Joe Biden in an honest election. Put aside the cheating. And there will be attempts to cheat. I understand that. I believe that the margin that Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump by in the last election is more or less set. And that Donald Trump has come to represent something in the minds of Americans, American voters, and that most American voters don't want to go to back to Donald Trump. The problem, of course, is that his support, his supporters had not are as loyal to him as ever. So it would be a close election, I presume. But I believe United States voters, well, first of all, they'd never given him a majority of the vote. Let's just keep that point in mind at cockamamie Electoral College. So listening to your explanation of things, and it was a really good one. Thank you. Though, essentially, what you're saying is that the system only works so long as both parties agree to abide by certain rules. So it's like a boxing match, if you will. I'll use this analogy. I love boxing. The rule in boxing is that you cannot hit below the belt. And if you hit below the belt, then you will be disqualified, essentially. Okay. Imagine a boxing match in which one of the fighters just said, no, I'm going to hit below the belt all I want, and I don't care. I will what the referee says, what the rules say, and I will proclaim myself the victor, and I'll take the victor's share, the belt, the championship belt, and there would really be nothing you could do about it in a situation like that. And essentially, what you're saying is that Donald Trump and the Republican Party have asserted their right to hit below the belt in the American political system, and. Yeah, it's going to be hard to beat. It's hard to beat somebody who says he will cheat. And this leads me to this point. I'd love to get your thoughts on this, because I had this moment of crisis, okay, this morning when I was sitting there looking out the window at the sunshine and the frigid Chicago weather. I thought to myself, I may have been wrong for the last couple of years to be urging Democrats in Illinois to gerrymander the hell out of Republicans. Okay, the much mentioned is I had this moment because I've been urging Dems. You know what? Until the Republicans stop gerrymandering in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Texas. Oh God, Texas. You know, we too can play that game. You want to cheat? We're going to cheat. And then I had this moment of doubt, David Ferris. I think it was when I was contemplating your essay. I thought, you know, I should have my principles. I should stick by my principles. And if gerrymandering is wrong for Republicans, it's wrong for Democrats. And I should uphold the principles in Illinois so that in the hopes that voters throughout the country will be inspired to uphold the principles in Nebraska or Texas or Florida. What's your position on this? It was just a moment of just utter weakness. That I should just let.
Yeah, Ben, give me your hand. I'm gonna walk you back from this ledge. Okay.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you. Help me out of here.
The problem is, like, of course, the principle should be that we don't draw district boundaries like solely to benefit our party and to disadvantage the other party, or, as actually has been the case more often this year, to protect our incumbents rather than drawing lines that make sense. Okay. That should be the principle. The practice should be nonpartisan commissions. You know, I have my own thoughts about those things have their flaws too in terms of exploitation of weak points, right? But they'd be vastly better than what we have now. There should be a national law passed out of Congress that should just prevent partisan gerrymandering from happening. This 100% has the authority to do that under the Elections Clause of the Constitution. It's in the For the People Act, which we can't get passed. Okay. And because we cannot get that passed through Joe Manchin's brain, we are stuck in this situation, which is kind of like a prisoner's dilemma. You know what the prisoner's dilemma is?
No.
Do you know this thought experiment? It's a piece of game theory. And there's a I used this in a couple of like a month or so ago in a column. And it's a situation, it's a, you and your friend are going to go do a little criming. And you agree beforehand, if you get caught, you're not going to talk. And in fact, you're terrible at crime. You get caught, you get hauled into separate rooms. Even though you agreed beforehand not to rat each other out, you are presented with very strong incentives in that room. Like if you sell the other person out, you can go free. If you both don't talk, maybe you get 2 years in prison. And if you are the one who gets sold out, you get 5 years in prison, you know? And so it's a situation where both sides would be better off collectively cooperating, but where the individual incentives are extremely strong to what we call defect, right? To sell the other person out. And that's the dynamic with like reforming the way that district lines are drawn. But it's worse than that, right? Because we are the only side that wants to do it. Right? We're not even in a situation, Ben, where it's like Democrats in Illinois and Republicans in Texas are like, I'll do it if you do it, right? Like if you do a nonpartisan redistricting, I promise I will do it too. The situation that we're in is one where Democrats are like, this is a terrible way to do this. We should get rid of this practice. And Republicans are like, yeah, we're going to gerrymander. I don't really see the problem here. This is what the founders intended, and the Supreme Court said we could do it, so we're going to do it. And so the only thing that you would accomplish by not gerrymandering Illinois is sending like two fewer Democrats to DC and making it that much harder for Democrats to win the House. Like there's nothing that we can do in Illinois to convince Republicans in Florida, Texas, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania that gerrymandering is wrong. If it was the case that sticking to our principles here could have the outcome of convincing Republicans in other states to stick to their principles, that would be great. But that's not who Republicans are right now. It's not just that we couldn't trust them to do it anyway. It's that they're saying they won't do it. Right? Like, we're not even in a prisoner's dilemma, because it's like when we got arrested, it's like one friend turned to the other one's like, yeah, I'm going to sell you out. Okay, see you later. Before the interview, before the interrogation, like, yeah, I'm definitely going to sell you out. So I should probably sell me out too. Let's just go to prison for a while. right? So, yeah, I mean, I don't like it. I mean, I don't like it any more than you do, but I also don't think there should be districts of the size that we gerrymandered, right? Like if we increased what we call the district magnitude and elected, you know, 3 or 5 people out of every district, you wouldn't be able to draw those lines in a way that would do this. It would be a much more fair way of representing the American people. That's why it's called the Fair Representation Act. It's been introduced into Congress multiple times now. Unfortunately, it's just not something that has drawn a lot of support, even from Democrats, because it would put everybody's job in jeopardy. And we can't have that in DC, yeah. Right? So,
well, then I'm
there. It is.
All right. So, to really complete the walking back from the ledge, confront this next point. To follow the logic that you just laid out, which is generally the logic that I've laid out for the last 2 years. Then I would say that the Democrats should try, if the Democrats lose the presidential election, and I have lose in quotes, in 2024 to Donald Trump, they should do to Trump what Trump tried to do to them, the exact same thing, and hijack the system at the local level, pervert the will of the voters, make up some reason that justifies in quotes, their actions. And then throw it to the House of Representatives, where if they had a majority, they would prevail. In other words, if we're going to sacrifice our principles for the sake of winning with gerrymandering, we should just take it to the next level and sacrifice our principles when it comes to fair, quote unquote, presidential elections. Because, again, it's the same basic dilemma. If one boxer does not abide by the rules, you can't have a fair fight. And so there are no more rules. And so it's just punch below the belt, punch over the head, whatever. Do you follow what I'm saying? So your response to that?
That's a bridge too far for me. I mean, I think I'm very much in favor of constitutional hardball, right? That is using all of the powers that are at your disposal under a fair reading of the U.S. Constitution, to increase the odds of your side winning, and holding on to power, which is all in the service of getting things done. You know, the end point, the point of politics is to resolve our disagreements peacefully, and to make good public policy that benefits people to the greatest extent that is possible in this very messy human society that we live in. If we decide that we are essentially going to not resolve those disagreements peacefully, you're subverting the whole point of democracy in the first place. And so instead of responding by organizing, you know, a similar effort, which I don't think we could pull off anyway, because we can't even talk ourselves into eliminating the filibuster, let alone stealing an election, I think that it may be something to a little more forward-looking and less hopeless, is we have to start laying the groundwork right now for what will be the mass popular response to a Republican attempt to overturn an election. You know what I mean? Like, you don't just like wake up overnight and say like, we're going to have a national general strike. Who's in? It's like that stuff needs to be worked on for years. We need to look back at other countries who have organized widespread occupy the town square protest events in an effort to overturn crooked election results. They called them the color revolutions earlier in this century in places like Ukraine and Georgia. And it's based on, you know, principles of nonviolent resistance. And we have a little under 3 years to think about how we're going to respond to this. Obviously, you know, you exhaust all legal options. One thing I don't think people are remembering is, in terms of not feeling hopeless, is that Joe Biden will actually still be the president when this is unfolding, right? In 2020, like, Trump was the president. He still failed to keep himself in office. Joe Biden would just be sort of fighting from the inside in an effort to prevent election theft from happening. And so I do think that there's probably some tools at his disposal that could be used. But fundamentally, some preparations need to be made by leading organizations on the left, linking together the labor movement and different protest movements, Black Lives Matter and teachers unions. And, you know, anybody that has organized collective power on the left needs to be brought together in a single project to resist the planned theft of the 2024 election. That's, you know, aside from holding your nose and turning out one more time to try to get Democrats into office, which I'm going to ask people to do, as frustrated as I am. We can vote, we can pressure our elected representatives to make these reforms. But unless you're in Arizona or West Virginia, it's not really going to do very much. And so what you have agency as an individual to do is to join some of these groups and embark on this journey of collective action. I'm guessing that Indivisible, which is a left organization, is going to be coordinating some of this stuff. But I'd like to see people talk a little bit more radically about how we would respond, because the big fear is that, you know, they're going to steal the election and we're just going to roll over and take it, right? Because, you know, I was talking about this in the article, like, you go to Hungary, which is a place that's no longer meaningfully a democracy. You walk around the streets of Budapest. It's not like there's people with AK-47s on the corners going to gun you down if you say that Viktor Orban's a bad prime minister or whatever, right? It's just that they've subtly rigged the system so that they can't lose. And they're not disrupting your everyday life. It's like, you know, you're going to go to work, go teach, go to your factory job, you know. And if people are not spurred on to do so, if people are not organized, that's what organizing is, right? This is not my specialty. But people do have to be organized if you want them to do something. And if we don't organize our own people in advance of the 2024 election for broad-based, nonviolent dissent, protests, and striking, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen spontaneously. It's not going to happen on its own. So that's something I think we really need to start talking about. Frankly, it would feel better than just like, you know, complaining about Joe Manchin. I mean, I do enjoy complaining about him. He's such an idiot.
Yeah.
He's not listening, and it's, you know, it's not necessarily going to achieve anything. So we have to be thinking about what we can do proactively in the event that this does happen.
All right. That was, you've talked me off the ledge. But I also point out that Democrats, if even they wanted to follow the Trump model for cheating, it wouldn't work for them because the flaw in the system that Trump is exploiting is one that is plays to the Republicans' advantage, and that is that small states count proportionally more than big states. Democrats don't control Wyoming, so the legislators, so we could flip Wyoming. You get what I'm saying? Like what they're trying to do in now, if somehow or other the Democrats took control of the Texas State House, maybe we could flip. Yeah, oh, my goodness. Could you imagine that?
What a beautiful day that would be. Have I ever talked on the show about my plan to relocate Democrats from California and New York to like North Carolina and Wyoming?
We've talked about that. Oh, my goodness. I've urged. Yes. And I remember. Oh my goodness! At one point, after Texas came up with that insane abortion law, Governor Pritzker here in Illinois was urging Texans to come to Illinois. We have we protect a woman's right to choose. I'm going, no, it's the other way around.
We got to get people out of here. Go to Texas.
Yeah, you got to go to. I'm like, once again, the Democrats don't even know how to play the game. Yeah, they're just. But yeah, you're absolutely correct. Move all those hipsters from Berkeley to Austin. Now, what is the difference between the two towns? I don't think there's any difference. And boom,
that's a lot of sunshine. You know?
Yeah, it's a lot of sunshine.
But it's another thing, and it comes back to this point, right? Which is like, sure, maybe some extremely altruistic or very, very politically committed people would do this, but if you want it to succeed, it has to be organized. You know, so yeah. If I'm some Democratic multi-billionaire, instead of running for president like an idiot, Tom Steyer, why don't you start an organization to like, you know, build 100,000 apartments in Cheyenne, Wyoming or whatever, and can get people to move there. Somebody's got to finance it. And, you know, like people not just like up and move somewhere politically. They have to be motivated to do so. They'd be organized. You'd only need like 200,000 people to flip like a bunch of those Mountain West states that are, you know, have the population of like half of one Chicago neighborhood. And it could be done. I mean, it's one of the more far-fetched ideas, I guess. But the line, if you can't beat them, join them. So, and I don't mean join the Republican Party. I mean, surround them. Like, hi, I'm your neighbor now. I'm taking over your state.
Yeah, here's an apple pie. All right. We'll close with your thoughts on Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz. You must have some thoughts of having watched or read about Tucker outrage at Ted Cruz for saying it was a terrorist act January 6th. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Ted Cruz is just such a puddle of jelly. I mean, that interview was why he will never be president, because he fundamentally has no principles whatsoever. And he's weak, you know, and the other people on the right sense his weakness and I'd like routinely exploit it and humiliate him. And yet he just like marches right back out there as Ted Cruz, you know, like I'm going to be a big target. Maybe his software turned off for a second and he briefly said what the truth is, you know, like he went to like Harvard or Yale or something. Like, he's not an idiot. Not that you have to go to these places to not be an idiot. Okay. But Ted Cruz is very, you know, highly educated man. He knows the election wasn't stolen. He knows what happened on January 6th. I'm sure he was cowering in his office like everyone else, thinking about what he's done wrong with his life. And, you know, he had a momentary slip of the tongue, and then he went back on Tucker to, you know, to fall on his sword, and is like, I shouldn't have said that. And Tucker just kept going at him. And he kept kind of, you know, it was a performance. Like he was performing for this puppet master, Tucker Carlson, who I think is the most, at this point, the most powerful conservative in the country. Just the audience that he commands and the loyalty of his audience and the way that his show has become, just the place that you go if you want to be part of the MAGA movement. You got to go make that pilgrimage to Tucker Carlson's show. And so Ted Cruz knows that if he wants to stay in good standing with the MAGA movement, he cannot cross this guy. You cannot cross Tucker Carlson in the Republican Party right now. He's that powerful. He will just light into you on his show. It's like Succession. Did you watch Succession, the show?
Oh my goodness, yes. Yeah, that's a whole other
story. The media empire.
You
know, the one of the things I liked about that show is the way they depicted what the network can do to individual people, because the network has no news principles, right? It's an it's a political operation. When they decide to go after you, they're going to come after you, and they can change minds. You know, no one defies Fox News in the long run. There's a, you know, Talking Points memo. It's this website run by Josh Marshall as a journalist. And early on in the Trump administration, he came up with this term to describe people who had spoken out against Trump and then had to go like kiss his ring later. And he called them dignity wraiths. So Ted Cruz is a dignity wraith, right? He's somebody, you can see it. He's been hollowed out because he allowed Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson to suck the dignity out of him as a human being. But he values staying in office and he values power more than he values his own dignity and his commitment to principles. And so he's just a sad, like Ted Cruz is just an awful, sad person who is like cosplaying the role of like some MAGA strongman, but can't even stand up to a talk show host. So screw that guy.
You know? Yeah, that's a great riff. And we'll see, by the way, the only one right now, Liz Cheney, who's standing up to MAGA. And Liz Cheney and I, if you take this out of the equation, agree on nothing. But I'm applauding her as she stands up to MAGA. We'll see if it works.
I don't think it's going to work. I think she's going to lose the primary. I mean, you know, God bless her for standing up for democracy. I mean, she's awful. The Cheneys are awful. You know, the Cheneys have done so much damage in the world. There's no way to redeem themselves. But it's a sad state of affairs, Ben, when we need the Cheneys to save democracy. Do you know what I mean? That's not good. We're not in a good place.
it's not at all. It's a sad state when we're turning to the Cheneys. Oh, God, help us all. All right, on that bleak, it wasn't so bad. I think you gave me a little area for hope, and you definitely talked me off the ledge. So it's been a very helpful conversation. I appreciate it. David Ferris, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, all right?
Sounds great, Ben. Thanks for having me on again, and I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks. Hopefully things will be better in a variety of ways by then. We'll see.
We will see. That's David Ferris. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.